This is Intercom Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by Endocrine Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Hello and welcome back to the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast for our 40th episode. For this month, we review a recent JCENM paper that looks at the impact of a diagnosis of gynecomastia on one's overall health. This study reports some novel findings, so we will think carefully about the methodology and the conclusions as we walk through it. As always, we will end our discussion with our opinions on the quality of the paper and whether it should change our clinical practice. Before I introduce our team for today, I'll remind you that I host the Endocrine Feedback Loop and work at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center as a general endocrinologist and medical director. Joining us again today as our regular contributor is Anna Goldman. She is currently in practice in Boston and teaches at Harvard Medical School. She also attends at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, where she was an APD for their fellowship for several years. One of her areas of clinical focus is reproductive endocrinology, which will be a benefit as we wrestle with this article today. With us today for the first time is our guest expert, Glenn Bronstein. He comes to us from Cedars-Sinai and UCLA, where he was the chair and vice chair of medicine, respectively. He is well known for his research and publications in several areas of endocrinology, but his expertise in male reproductive endocrinology will be called on today. As is invariably the case for this podcast, the perfect pair of endocrinologists joins me today to unpack this study. As always, everything we say will be our opinions only and not those of our respective institutions or the Endocrine Society. For this month's edition of the podcast, we look at increased morbidity in males diagnosed with gynecomastia, a nationwide register-based cohort study. The Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism published this article in July 2023 out of the University of Copenhagen with Cecily Oldbjerg as the first author. Anna will take things over at this point. She will walk us through the author's introduction, giving an overview of the main points that they make. She will also get Glenn to give us more background on gynecomastia in general to help us understand this investigation a bit better. Anna?
Thanks, Chase. So gynecomastia is a common condition where there is a benign enlargement of the male breast tissue, and this typically results from estrogen stimulation or decreased androgen inhibition of breast glandular tissue growth. Any cause of estrogen excess from either overproduction to increased peripheral aromatization of androgens can lead to breast development. True gynecomastia has to be distinguished from pseudogynecomastia, which is caused by an excessive amount of breast adipose tissue, but this is not true glandular tissue. Gynecomastia has three distinct age peaks during life, during infancy, puberty, and older age. In infancy, there's thought to be an increased placental transfer of maternal estrogens. In puberty, gynecomastia usually occurs due to an increase in testosterone secretion, which is subsequently aromatized to estrogen. And with the onset of puberty, this is actually fairly common. Up to 50 to 70% of boys actually show transient gynecomastia, which generally resolves spontaneously. The incidence of gynecomastia in older men and the associated health risks have actually not been fully elucidated. Glenn, would you mind commenting on what causes of gynecomastia you see in your patients and how you evaluate and then treat them?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for the invitation to participate today. Older individuals have probably multifactorial reasons for developing gynecomastia. First of all, as we age, we increase our body fat, decrease our lean body mass. And body fat is known to contain the aromatase enzyme that converts testosterone to estradiol. In addition, studies have shown that as we age, the fat cells actually increase their individual aromatase activity. So not only do we have an aging effect as far as increasing fat mass in general, but we also have an increased amount of aromatase per fat cell taking place. So overall, there's increased production of estradiol from testosterone as we age. That may be one factor accounting for gynecomastia occurring in older individuals. Secondly, older individuals take a number of medications that are associated with gynecomastia, such as spironolactone, gonadotropin types of preparations, anti-androgen preparations for the treatment of prostate cancer, for instance. So there are a variety of factors, a variety of medications that older individuals may take that may contribute to gynecomastia. Thirdly, there's an increased risk of developing primary and secondary hypogonadism as we age. Certainly, It's been shown that testosterone production can decrease as we age. Sex hormone binding globulin goes up as we age, which binds more testosterone relative to estradiol. And this may lead to a decrease in free testosterone and a concomitant increase in luteinizing hormone because there's decreased negative inhibition of the pituitary gland. The increase in luteinizing hormone also increases aromatase activity. So we have this multifactorial problem going on as we age that does contribute to the propensity for developing gynecomastia. In addition, a number of clinicians will see an older individual with enlarged breasts and call it gynecomastia, whereas it may not be true gynecomastia. As you mentioned, true gynecomastia is the increased production of breast glandular tissue. But the breast is made up also of fat. And as we age, as we get fatter, if you will, and as obesity has increased in the population, we do find that a number of individuals will develop pseudogynecomastia or increased fat in their breasts without having a true increase in breast glandular tissue. So it's very important on physical examination to try to discriminate between true gynecomastia and pseudogynecomastia.
With regards to the evaluation that you would recommend when you see a patient with true gynecomastia, where do you typically start?
Well, the first thing is, that is the patient coming in because of breast enlargement that they've noticed? Do they have breast tenderness? Is there a discharge, for instance? Is it bilateral? And the first thing you do when you see an individual like that with those types of complaints is get a good history to see what medications they're on. Are they ingesting copious amounts of alcohol? Could this be a liver disease, which is associated with gynecomastia? Have they had kidney problems? Do they have any other signs or symptoms of feminization that might be going on? So a full history is the first thing. And if they are complaining of recent onset of gynecomastia and your examination does confirm that, you certainly want to look for signs and symptoms of hyperthyroidism, of liver disease, of renal disease, of masses in the abdomen that could be an adrenal cortical carcinoma, a very good testicular exam because of the issues of hypogonadism or testicular tumors. Certainly seminomas may produce chorionic gonadotropin, which acts like luteinizing hormone and stimulates aromatase activity and increases estrogen production. So the physical examination is very important. If nothing is found through history, it doesn't give hints as to what's causing the gynecomastia, the physical examination isn't productive, then again, if it's of recent onset, I usually recommend getting a serum testosterone, luteinizing hormone. I also add follicle stimulating hormone because it's often more times more sensitive for primary hypogonadism than luteinizing hormone, and estradiol. If there's any suggestion of hyperthyroidism, I'll also add a TSH at that time. And based on the results, we'll go further with the diagnostic workup or not. If everything's normal, generally, we will just monitor the patient. The other situation, which is actually much more common, is that a patient comes in for a physical examination or for another complaint, and during your examination, you discover gynecomastia. And this is asymptomatic gynecomastia. The patient may never have been aware of it. And if the patient is not having any problems, then clearly a good physical examination and a good testicular examination is in order. I do recommend getting a testosterone and luteinizing hormone in that setting to look for especially primary hypogonadism, because that's such an easy thing to treat and the gynecomastia generally remits or resolves. One other thing I should mention is that the definition of gynecomastia, how much glandular tissue is enlarged glandular tissue, has been debated for some time. But there was a recent study that looked at CT examinations of individuals coming to an emergency room for trauma. And it was noted in this very nice study looking at CT evidence of gynecomastia or pseudogynecomastia that many men will have some breast tissue. And that if you look at the 90% confidence limits of what is the upper limit of normal for breast tissue found on CT exam, it turns out to be about 2 centimeters. So right now, anything less than 2 centimeters is probably well within the normal range. Over 2 centimeters would be considered pathologic gynecomastia.
And so previous data suggests an increasing incidence of gynecomastia. Based off of what you said, I think a lot of this may potentially be related to increased prevalence of obesity in our population. Any other thoughts, Glenn or Chase, about why we're seeing this increased incidence?
As I mentioned, I think that clearly the marked increase in obesity prevalence in the population has resulted in a lot of pseudogynecomastia and possibly concomitant gynecomastia. The relationship between obesity and gynecomastia is still a little bit controversial. There were early studies at a veterans hospital that demonstrated a direct correlation between body mass index and the presence of gynecomastia and the size of the breast tissue. The study that I mentioned, looking at CT exams on patients coming in an emergency room with trauma, did not find a relationship between body mass index and presence of gynecomastia. So that is still controversial. But I do think obesity will lead to an increase in pseudogynecomastia, which oftentimes is misdiagnosed as gynecomastia. Secondly, there's an increased use of medications, and there's a lot of use of testosterone in the aging male. We have these a number of clinics that have opened up around the country to promulgate the use of hormones to treat anti-aging. And so if they give testosterone, that can be aromatized estradiol, which can stimulate breast development. If they give growth hormone, which many of these clinics also do, growth hormone has also been associated with the occurrence of gynecomastia. So there are a number of factors that may be related to why we're seeing what looks like increasing incidence and prevalence of gynecomastia in the population.
So the health impact of gynecomastia is not fully known, although mental health consequences have been proposed. So the authors for this study used a nationwide register-based database in Denmark to assess previous morbidities and assess future disease risks associated with gynecomastia. So I'll turn it to you, Chase.
Great, Anna, thanks. And Glenn as well for giving us that great background to help us understand clinically how we think about gynecomastia. So what we're going to start with, as we normally do, is just thinking about the study design that's used here and looking at how the authors approach this. They have a couple of different approaches, but for their main analysis, I think the most helpful way of thinking about this is through the lens of a retrospective cohort study. We've looked at a lot of these over the past few years on this podcast, but just as a reminder of how those work, a cohort study is when you have a group of people, cohort, and they share something in common. But within that cohort, you have at least two groups, and sometimes it's multiple, but at least two in its simplest form, one that is exposed to something and one that is unexposed to something. And then what makes it a cohort study is that you follow those individuals over time. When it is a prospective cohort study, you are following them in real time. You're doing it with them and collecting data as you go along. With retrospective studies, you start the study after all of the data has been collected. So as we'll see here, this is often in a database, and you're going back and accessing that. You're still able to reconstruct that time sequence so you know what happened first, you know the exposure happened, and then you're able to follow and then see that later the outcomes happen. So there is still that time component, even though you've begun your study after all of that data is available. So that's, I think, how I would encourage us to think about this. So to get into the particulars of this investigation, this is a Danish register-based cohort study, and it had quite a few individuals, so over 140,000 males. So when we get into that and then think about the, what's the exposure, what's the unexposed group, and the exposure here is gynecomastia. And they had over 23,000 individuals who were diagnosed with gynecomastia, and they looked over quite a few years to get that information. So starting in back in 1995 and going all the way up through June 30th of 2021. So what they then did to find their unexposed individuals, they looked through other database to find age and calendar matched males who did not have gynecomastia. And for every case or for every exposure that they had, they found five males who did not have a diagnosis of gynecomastia. And you can do, whenever you do this matching, it can be as simple as a one-to-one. So finding one unexposed individual for an exposed individual, you do increase your power a little bit when you start adding additional individuals to be in the unexposed group. And so that's why they did that, this 1-to-5. And usually it's relatively straightforward. When you have a large database like they have access to, you can increase your power to find some differences there. So that's what they did. And doing so then led to over 117,000 individuals, males that would be in this unexposed, this comparison group. And the approach that they use here, mentioned it, is matching. There's a couple different ways whenever you're trying to address confounders. We're going to think about confounders a little bit more here shortly. But as a reminder of what those are going to be something that is really driving the outcome. It's related to the exposure as well. And so if you don't account for it, it can make it look like there's an actual connection, a causative relationship between the exposure and the outcome, when it may be mitigated, if not fully explained, by this other thing that is related to both the exposure and the outcome. So one example here of how they've addressed that is, well, age can do that as well. We just heard that gynecomastia is more common the older that you get. So one of the ways that you then address age here is that you match based on that, is you make sure that your individuals are of the same age. An alternative that you can do, it's not what was done here, but an alternative way to address confounders is to adjust for it. So you have your group, your cohort, and you do your initial analysis. And then afterwards, you try to identify everything that could be a confounder, and you figure out statistically what the impact is, and then you negate that, you remove that afterwards. So both of these are perfectly acceptable, and the matching is what was done here. And at this point, what I would like to do is to get Glenn's input on this. So we talked about matching, but there wasn't a lot here. So again, what the authors state is that it was age and calendar match, but not much else besides that. Later on, the authors do mention that they weren't able to match based on obesity. And then, as we've heard already, that could have an impact. But Glenn, what are your thoughts about relative limited matching that's done at the beginning of this study?
Yeah. Well, first of all, the Danish registry system and the IRB that's used to access that system and evaluate possible associations is really rather limited access. That is, the authors are not able, haven't been given permission to go back into the charts to really see if the individuals had true gynecomastia or pseudogynecomastia, and what the size was and what type of workup was done. So the best that they can do is what you said, which is to match by age and by date of ascertainment. The other problem that I find with this is that they have an earlier study, which was also a very interesting and provocative study by Koch, that was published in 2020 in Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism, which used the same registry. And in there, they said that, and I'll quote them, the diagnosis of gynecomastia is limited to a few specialized hospital outpatient clinics by trained clinicians in Denmark and determined according to the European Academy of Andrology Clinical Practice Guidelines, gynecomastia evaluation and management, parentheses, breast tissue by palpation, end parentheses. So basically, they're saying that the diagnosis of gynecomastia is made in a few specialized centers, but they're now drawing on the entire population of men to age and date match the individuals. So I would posit that the evaluation at a medical center might be a bit different than the evaluation in the countryside, where perhaps the majority of Danish men are being seen.
Thanks. And I think that's really helpful. We're going to think about this at several points along the way. Definitely worth pointing that out here. And then as Anna starts walking us through the results here in a few minutes, we're going to think about that a little bit more. And the way I might frame that, there's a few different ways that you could think about that. One thing that the authors point out is with that is it's just possible that folks who were diagnosed with gynecomastia have had more interactions with the healthcare system, so they have more opportunities to be diagnosed with something else. I think another thing that's going to be really helpful is really what Glenn has mentioned here, is that often this is really specialized folks who know exactly what they're doing who are making this diagnosis. The importance of that, there's a couple of other things that are important. Is one is that if you're going to make a diagnosis of gynecomastia and you're an expert in it, then it's also very likely that you are an expert in knowing what the potential causes are, things that you need to be looking for. So then because of that, you are then going to be looking for other morbidities that those individuals may have. Those morbidities may be present throughout the population, but if you're not looking for them, you may not know that. And the way that's described is that's an ascertainment bias. As far as clinical care goes, that's exactly what you should be doing. That's what a good provider does. But when you then turn that into a research study, you do get worried that you're not looking for outcomes the same in these groups. And so it may just be you're finding it more in one group because you are looking for it more. A similar issue that can come up is a reporting bias. That's a little bit different. It's not that you've looked for anything different, but that you've decided to report it. A good example of this, it probably doesn't have a big impact here, but the authors do mention it later, is the possibility of marijuana. So it's controversial as to whether that's connected to gynecomastia at all. But if you didn't have a reason to report that your patient was a user of marijuana, of cannabis, then you probably wouldn't use the ICD-10 code for that. However, if you were worried that that actually might be related to your patient's gynecomastia, then you might be much more inclined to report that because you're worried about that connection. Again, that's good patient care, but when you turn that into a research study, you get worried that you're seeing these signals here merely because of the provider's behavior is different, not primarily because there's something different about the patient. So we're going to think a lot about those things. So as far as the diagnoses go, they were based on ICD-10 codes. And an interesting feature of what's done in this study and in this healthcare system is that there are what are called ABC extensions that allow for more specific diagnoses related to gynecomastia. And in particular, there's two subgroups that the authors were interested in. One is idiopathic gynecomastia, and then the other is gynecomastia related to a known pre-existing condition or medication use. Glenn mentioned some of those to us already. The authors do a good job of describing those. They also mentioned that there's actually not a lot of data supporting the connection of what we often say are causes of gynecomastia. So it is expert opinion. So we don't know for sure for some of those things as to whether they're drivers of gynecomastia, but that is how they group that. And then just a few final words here. So as far as those outcomes, those morbidities and those cancers, where those came from, it was the Danish National Patient Registry, and then also another registry, the Danish Cancer Registry. And they used ICD-10 codes to find those outcomes as well, those morbidities. And they looked through all 13 disease chapters is the way that those are organized. Okay, so just a final word on the statistics before we move on from the methods. So they grouped these males into predefined age groups, and that was roughly related to the peak times of when gynecomastia shows up. Anna outlined for us already, but less than 10 was a group, ages 10 to 18, 19 to 40, and then greater than 40. The main analysis, and when I described this as a retrospective cohort study, it was from their description of the main analysis, but they did a Cox proportional hazards regression model to look at disease risk after you had been diagnosed with gynecomastia. So again, your cohort are these males, your exposure is gynecomastia, yes or no, and then it's looking at all of these potential outcomes to see if it happens more in one group versus another. They did a secondary analysis, Anne alluded to it already, but that was a logistic regression model to look at gynecomastia risk with pre-existing morbidity. So a little bit different approach there, but something I think that's going to be helpful for us to think about as well. Okay, now that we've laid some of the groundwork there, I'm going to hand it back over to Anna, and she is going to walk us through the results as the authors present them.
Thanks, Chase. So of the original 23,429 individuals who were diagnosed with gynecomastia, 69.4%, or just over 16,000 men, were identified as having idiopathic gynecomastia. They were younger than I would have expected. They were predominantly aged 19 to 40 years old. That was 44.3% of the cohort. And they had a statistically significant higher risk of future disease across all included disease chapters, with endocrine diseases representing the greatest disease risk with a hazard ratio of 1.89. This was mainly driven by disorders of endocrine glands with a hazard ratio of 7.27, followed by overweight and obesity with a hazard ratio of 2.33. Chase, did you want to comment on how these results might represent some of the biases that you mentioned earlier?
Yeah, I'm going to circle back because I think this really well illustrates it, and we'll keep wrestling with this. But I think you're seeing it already at the very beginning is that it shows up with every single outcome category or chapter that they looked at. I think it would be a bit more compelling if you could say, well, it was only related to this one or that one. And yeah, that really makes sense from a pathophysiology perspective why we would see that. But I do think you get worried when you say, wow, this is related to every single category of morbidity that we looked at. There's a higher risk for that. That's where you really start worrying about. Yeah, it could be like the authors say later on, maybe it's just these folks are getting more exposure to the healthcare system, so more opportunities to be diagnosed with something. Or again, I'm worried about some of those other things that we talked about here. Perhaps the practitioners here, the clinicians are looking differently or reporting differently, and that's why we're seeing it in so many different areas. But Glenn, what are your thoughts here? There certainly is a much stronger signal with endocrine conditions, and I think that makes sense from what you said before, but can you circle back and just give us some insight into how you would think about that aspect in particular?
Well, first of all, one of the most common causes of idiopathic gynecomastia is actually persistent pubertal gynecomastia. So we do know that upwards of two-thirds of adolescents, usually during Tanner stage 3 or 4 of general development, will have at least transient gynecomastia, but anywhere between as low as 1% to as high as 20%, depending on the series that you look at, of those patients will have some persistence of gynecomastia. And many times that will be diagnosed as idiopathic because no other cause is found when the patient presents in their 20s or so for evaluation. The endocrine causes that one needs to consider would be certainly primary or secondary hypogonadism, as we mentioned. Hyperthyroidism is also associated with gynecomastia that fortunately is transient after the hyperthyroidism is taken care of. The most worrisome conditions are tumors. Fortunately, they're relatively rare, but tumors of the testicles, either germ cell tumors that produce chorionic gonadotropin, or Leydig cell tumors that may produce estradiol directly, and then adrenocortical tumors, adrenocortical carcinoma, occasionally adrenal adenomas, but when adrenal tumors are producing sex steroids, especially if they're producing glucocorticoids or mineralocorticoids also, these are malignancies of the adrenal gland. And then there's ectopic production of chorionic gonadotropin by non-trophoblastic tumors, so tumors that are not of germ cell origin. And these would be such things as lung carcinomas or hepatocellular carcinomas. Renal carcinoma, as has been described. We also have the potential for unadmitted to medications, such as androgen use. We mentioned androgen use in adults for treating possibly a single low testosterone level that that some clinicians will then go ahead and treat with testosterone, but also adolescents and young men who are bodybuilding. Oftentimes will use anabolic steroids and may not report this to their primary care physician. The authors of this study and their prior study also raised the possibility of environmental estrogens or estrogen-like agents causing an increase in the incidence of gynecomastia in Denmark and possibly being co-associated with other problems. And we certainly do know that at least in vitro, there are a number of materials, molecules that will have estrogen-like action. Certainly in vitro, you see this with tea tree oil to some extent and lavender oil. You see it with plasticizers, bisphenol A. So there are a variety of environmental estrogen-like agents that at least in vitro will have an effect. We don't know really whether these have an in vivo effect or if it's just a phenomenology of adding a medication to an estrogen receptor and seeing it turn a bind to the estrogen receptor as you do in vitro. So there are a lot of factors to consider, but fortunately, most of these endocrine problems can be diagnosed by history and physical examination.
So for the endocrine diseases, the highest hazard ratios were observed in the younger age group, 20 to 40, after which the hazard ratios declined with age at the time of diagnosis. And this was true both for idiopathic and just having gynecomastia overall. The disease risks following gynecomastia with a known risk factor were statistically elevated across all disease chapters as well, with the highest incidence being diseases of the blood with a hazard ratio of 2.42 and endocrine disorders again with a hazard ratio of 2.34. Glenn, what are your thoughts about a possible unifying explanation for this?
The best explanation, I think, would be an ascertainment bias. But if indeed this is real and it's replicable with other studies, and even by these authors getting permission to go in and delve deeper into the association that they describe, one possibility would be a chronic illness leading to a decrease in the pulsatility, pulsatile release of LH and FSH and secondary hypogonadism. And if that occurs, even though the testosterone level goes down, and that's the main source of hormonization to estradiol in peripheral tissues, you still have the adrenal gland making estradiol precursors, if you will. So you can get an imbalance between estradiol and testosterone with secondary hypogonadism. And we do see, like in the intensive care unit, so when people come in very sick, their gonadotropins really drop down, their testosterone levels drop down, and when they recover from their acute illness, things return to normal. So that is a plausible explanation.
So the predominant existing risk factors for all ages diagnosed before or on the date of gynecomastia were, unsurprisingly, medications, alcohol addiction, hypogonadism, malignant neoplasm, and obesity. The odds ratios of prior incident comorbidities among males with idiopathic gynecomastia were higher across all included disease sections, except for psychiatric disease, which is interesting, with the highest association with musculoskeletal or connective tissue and circulatory diseases. The authors postulated that this may be because there's a relatively large group of patients with psychiatric disease who don't really have the capacity to seek further medical assessment for other mild diseases like gynecomastia. Potentially, so another ascertainment bias leading to these results.
Thanks, Anna. So now we're going to move at this point on into the discussion and the conclusion as put together by the authors, and we're going to keep thinking through some of these things. So I'll start with a couple of quotes from the author. So first of all, we found that idiopathic gynecomastia was associated with a statistically significant higher risk of future disease across all included ICD-10 disease chapters, especially for endocrine diseases. And then another quote, we clearly demonstrate a marked increased morbidity among males diagnosed with gynecomastia. So I'll comment on that second one. We're really teasing things apart, but I do think it is important distinction here is when the authors say that there's an increased morbidity. I would say what we clearly have here is that there's an increase in recorded diagnosis of morbidity. I'm still not completely sure that we know that these folks are actually sicker, so to speak, than guys who don't have gynecomastia. It's diagnosed more, but that is not necessarily going to be the same, again, when you're using these database type studies. And a few other comments that the authors make. So they've split a couple of their findings into something that was expected into something that they listed or described as unexpected. So first of all, something that they expected to see from their previous work is the gynecomastia cases that were identified with a known risk factor. So that was not surprising at all. If you had something that was likely to drive and cause gynecomastia, then it's not surprising that they found it more frequently in those males. What was unexpected, though, are the identified health effects associated with idiopathic gynecomastia. So no identified reason to have the gynecomastia, so unclear then what's driving those other things that they're finding. So again, potentially related to what we've talked about already. The authors then make another comment that I wanted to get Glenn's thoughts on. So what they say, and again, I'll quote them here, is our results clearly illustrate the importance of early diagnosis, full clinical examination, and follow-up of these males to identify underlying pathologies. And where I'd like Glenn's thoughts, I'll maybe be a little bit cynical here, is thinking that, and this may be very well founded, and they are calling for nothing more than good clinical care. So I don't think in and of itself, I don't think anything that they're saying here is out of line. I do wonder, though, if this approach of being, say, very thorough to try to investigate for a cause is potentially why we found this association in the first place. Is that what's actually driving the ascertainment bias, if that is what we're seeing here, is because these individuals are getting such a thorough investigation. And I'll say maybe it's thorough because at onset, it's not obvious that they have any underlying diseases. So you have to do a thorough investigation to attempt to find something. So I've maybe showed my hand there just a little bit. But Glenn, thoughts on that as far as that recommendation that has come from the authors here?
I think the clinician needs to differentiate between true gynecomastia and pseudogynecomastia. That's the first thing. And if there's true gynecomastia, is it within the physiologic range, which is less than 2 centimeters? And if it's over 2 centimeters, especially if it's of recent origin, then yes, I do think that one should look for a comorbidity that is associated or potentially causing the gynecomastia. If it's just a finding on physical examination, if it's under 2 centimeters, then good testicular exam and good thyroid exam, the things that should be done anyway should be performed. I don't think that one needs to do much more than possibly just checking a testosterone and luteinizing hormone, as I mentioned before, if one is picking up gynecomastia, because primary hypogonadism is a relatively common cause of gynecomastia, and it does increase with age. Other than that, I wouldn't go on much of a fishing expedition to try to look for other comorbidities if they are not apparent from history and physical examination and possibly the testosterone and LH results.
Thank you. I think that's really helpful to tease apart the nuance just a little bit, the timing of the onset and the severity of that gynecomastia to help guide what further investigation might be needed. And we'll move towards the end here, and we'll next stop, we'll be thinking about the strengths and the limitations as reported by the author. So the strengths that they say, they point out this is a nationwide registry. And so because of that is a large study. They do point out that thinking about ascertainment bias, it's actually fairly limited, at least as far as socioeconomic factors go. And the reason for that is the way that the healthcare system is structured in Denmark is because it is does not cost the patient at the point of accessing care, that it's unlikely or at least fairly limited impact of an ascertainment bias from people seeking or not seeking care. And then finally, one more strength that they point out is that the population-based design provided clinically important associations. So limitations, I think the authors do a good job here of thinking through all these issues, a lot of which we have wrestled with already. Again, they point out the ascertainment bias, and they really focus on it from the frequency or degree of interaction with the healthcare system if you've been diagnosed with gynecomastia. They do point out that in any of these studies, you've got to worry about misclassification or misdiagnoses. Inaccurate diagnoses would be a similar issue there. And we talked about this before, but they do point out that what they have described as risk factors for gynecomastia, that is based on anecdotal reports, and some of them have controversy, for example, the cannabis use. And then they do also indicate, as I think always has to be thought through in observational studies, that there's always a good chance for residual confounding. They matched based on age and the time, that calendar time of diagnosis, but they say there's other things. We mentioned obesity already, and Glenn pointed out for us already, the endocrine disrupting chemicals and steroid use potentially could have an impact there, and it was not something that they were able to look at. Finally here, we'll go to the author's conclusions. And so the way I would describe it is a summary and then maybe a recommendation that they have for us. So the summary that they have for us is that idiopathic gynecomastia was associated with a marked increased risk of future diseases. And then their recommendation based on that was, we hope our present findings will stimulate more awareness among healthcare providers to increase identification of gynecomastia and its causes in males. So we're going to think about that final statement and how that maybe should affect our care. But before we get to that, I just want us to think about the quality of this report overall. So Anna, maybe we'll start with you as you were looking through this and analyzing this with me. What are your thoughts and impressions just on the quality of the report?
It was a huge cohort, and I think they had access to a lot of data that we wouldn't necessarily be able to review here in the United States. So I think it was an important article from that standpoint, but I think there are a lot of biases that we've talked a lot about in this podcast thus far, which makes me interpret the results with a grain of salt.
And we'll come back to that here in just a second. Glenn, though, before we do that, just thoughts on quality of the report overall?
Yeah, I agree with Anna. I actually think that one of the nicest things about the Danish system is that they do have this, besides the standard ICD-10 diagnoses, they have the ABC extension. If you just look at our current ICD-10 classification in the United States, gynecomastia is included with basically any type of breast enlargement, if you will. And so you can't discriminate between gynecomastia and pseudogynecomastia, true gynecomastia. There can be breast hypertrophy from pubertal breast hypertrophy, for instance, is included in there. But with the ABC extension that the Danish researchers are able to use, it's much more specific for gynecomastia. It doesn't exclude potentially pseudogynecomastia, but it should if the examination is done properly. So again, I think that is a benefit of the study. The thing that I like about this study is that I would hope that it will stimulate other groups to examine other databases and to get into the weeds much more to see if there is indeed an association between the presence of gynecomastia, which I think, you know, if anything, it might be an epiphenomenon, if you will, you know, that it's not certainly not causing anything, but if there's a common cause or there's a problem that's increasing aromatization, that would be just one clinical manifestation, and that we may get much more specific information as you get into the weeds as to which conditions gynecomastia really might be associated with that clinicians can look for. Right now, there's, as has been pointed out, virtually every large group of conditions, 13 classes of conditions that they looked at, were associated with gynecomastia in this group, which also, as mentioned, says that this is a, in this particular setting, there probably is this major bias between the academic medical centers where the clinicians know how to diagnose gynecomastia versus the rest of the healthcare system where they may not examine for the gynecomastia unless somebody's complaining of breast enlargement. But I hope this stimulates further research. It's very interesting. I wouldn't change my practice based on this, but I hope to stimulate further research.
Yeah, and I agree. I think some of the nice features of this, as clinicians, I think we're always tortured by our electronic health record. And when it prompts us, when we're putting in the ICD-10 codes and trying to be as specific as possible and having an overwhelming number of codes to choose from. But I think this really nicely illustrates that in systems, the healthcare systems that use very specific forms of this ABC extension, I think it was really nice to see what can be done with that. And I think the authors do a really good job of that. So, and Glenn gave us some thoughts already here about changing clinical practice. He's not ready to quite do that yet. I'm here in a second. We'll see what Anna thinks about that. I agree, though. I think this is going to be a great stimulation for more research and where to go from here. But Anna, why don't you wrap things up for us in particular? And maybe I'll put some words in the author's mouth. They did not say this, but I'll maybe push it. So they call for increased identification of gynecomastia. I suspect that doesn't mean in individuals who are coming in complaining of gynecomastia, because I think we're all going to be fairly prompted to do something about that. So I think really the only way to increase identification is to screen people for it. Again, authors don't say that, so I'm putting words in their mouth on that. But I'm just curious as to you would advocate for something like that. So in your practice, or in, say, if you're talking to your colleagues who are primary care providers in the Boston area, what are your thoughts on that? Do you think we need to advocate for a change in practice, or not quite yet?
I think it depends. Is the patient coming in for a well visit versus, you know, if they have another specific complaint? But, you know, certainly if somebody is coming in for fatigue, or I suspect hypogonadism, or if I see that the patient has overweight or obesity, I'm going to look for gynecomastia in addition to pseudogynecomastia. In addition to doing a really good physical exam, you know, if they are presenting with complaints about breast tenderness, I'm going to do a good testicular exam, a good thyroid exam. But I think the importance of a good history is also really important. In my own practice, I'm seeing a lot of men, young men, taking anabolic steroids, and there's a lot of stigma surrounding that. So that's not something they necessarily want to disclose to their doctor. They may not want to disclose that they're using opiates or marijuana. And we know about all of the adverse comorbidities that can come with that. So I think just keeping an open mind and creating an environment in the office where the patient feels comfortable disclosing those things.
And with that, I would like to thank Anna Goldman and Glenn Bronstein for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I hope that you all learned as much as I did, and look forward to you all joining us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of the Endocrine Society, with production oversight by Brandy Brown and Andrew Harmon.